All lines are now bridged.
Great, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Berry with OSC, and I'd like to welcome you all back to the U.S. CDI Task Force. We really appreciate you being with us today. I'm going to open up today's meeting with roll call, and I'll start with our co-chairs. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Leslie Kelly Hall.
Hello.
Ricky Bloomfield.
Good morning, I'm here.
Hans Butendijk. Reyes Cordovano. Jim Durgis. Ken Kawamoto. John Kilbourne.
Good morning.
Leslie Leonard. Glenn McDonald. Aaron Meary. Brett Oliver. Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber. Abby Sears. Sasha Terma.
Good morning.
Andrew Truscott. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Daniel Breeman.
Good morning.
And Denise Webb.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I see a number of other high-tech or other task force members joining us, and we'll take note of their attendance as we go. And I'd now like to turn it over to our co-chairs, Stephen and Leslie.
Thank you so much, Mike. And sorry, my camera is not working. I just downloaded the new Adobe, and it looks different, but it's not giving me that option. So you'll have to believe that I'm standing here in foggy California, and it's all good. Thank you all, as usual, for joining us. I see we've got great participation this morning and really appreciate people's time and attention. We continue to endeavor to post our past meeting notes to the web. I actually have the last 2 weeks waiting for me to review them. I'm going to hopefully get to that today, and we'll get those up shortly. We continue to focus in on our Phase 3, Task 3 recommendations today, and we will, of course, have public comment 5 minutes before the end of our meeting. As always, we really do invite any members of the public who are joining us this morning to feel free to chime in and offer us verbal commentary. I actually don't see any public members this morning. Usually they're here with us, but maybe they'll join. Did anyone have anything else that they wanted to be sure that we touched on today that's not on the agenda?
I think we're good.
Great. Okay. I think on the next slide, we have a reminder of our task three. And here it is, a reminder that we've been through our phases one and two, have made our recommendations to the HITECH, and they have been transmitted to the national coordinator. And now we're working on developing recommended priorities for the version three submission cycle. I think we're all looking forward to July 8, in just a couple of weeks, when Al has told us that USCDI version 2 is going to be published, as well as the guidance for the version 3 submission cycle, which of course is already in process, but has not had a lot of traction. Al, is there anything you want to tell us about the July 8 plans, anything we should be aware of?
Only that date is not an official date, and it's subject to change.
All right. Very good. And we do have planned our next meeting after today will be July 20, when we are going to be reviewing the version 2 publication, as well as the guidance for the version 3 cycle. Actually, it's interesting. I'm sure, Al, the team is hard at work putting together all of those materials and preparing for their publication and communication. And our task force, we hope, has had a chance to inform that process. It'll be great to see how you've put that all together and what we're going to be up for the next cycle. So today what we wanted to do was go back to the documents that we have been rather slowly and painstakingly constructing with our recommendations for version 3. We started, you will recall, and I don't know, Al, if you want to be ready to pull up our two Google Docs, I think that would be great. But we started initially developing a spreadsheet that described specific data elements that we thought were worth discussing. And we used that when we made especially our version 1 recommendations. Since then, we did identify a number of those data elements that we were going to defer for our task 3. And we have that list in the spreadsheet that is mostly things that we talked about early on. There are a couple that have been added since based on discussions both with the ISP task force and the public health folks. Mark has put a lot of effort into adding a couple of items in that spreadsheet. But I think the real key question in my mind, and one that I hope we can address, is whether it's necessary for us as a task force in our task 3 submissions to be focused on individual data elements. There is, as we well know, and as we have provided commentary, there is an established process through the OnDeck for stakeholders to submit data elements, to provide commentary and support for data elements, and there is a clear path for data elements to be elevated from comment to level 1 to level 2 into a draft and subsequently into a final version of USCBI. We've added a lot of commentary as to how we think that ought to go, and we'll see what ONC has done with our ideas. But at the level of individual data elements, I don't really know that having the task force throw their weight behind them at this point in the process really makes sense. I think when we start the next process and we're invited to provide input on a draft version 3, then it really makes sense to get into the individual data elements. But at this point, I mean, a data element is either going to be submitted or it won't. It's going to be leveled according to specific criteria. And I'm just not personally sure what good it does for us to spend a lot of time focused on individual data elements at this point in the cycle. So interested to hear what other people think about that perspective before we dive into individual data elements and discussing them.
So, Stephen, I also agree with you, because I think what has come up through this process has really been items that could be reflected as guiding principles or clarification requests at a very high level. And so I think that's where we've ended up with most of our emphasis on the V3 comments. So I agree with that approach.
Does anyone feel differently?
We have a lot of agreement coming through the chat.
Okay. Hans, Cheryl.
Mark's hands are raised. Mark?
Sure. So I think the one thing I'd add is I think it is okay for us to have thoughts now about gaps. We've had that conversation in recommending how ONC sets priorities. So yes, we've laid out those principles, but in the interest of sort of making most efficient use of time in a linear process, I do think any thoughts here from the task force on gaps could be useful without getting into the minutia of individual data elements.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Thank you. And thank you for task force members who are joining late. Welcome. So again, I think what I had hoped to do was kind of quickly run down the list of submitted data elements. I don't want to spend too much time on it if we can avoid it, but just see if there's something there that really does warrant a flag or a commentary recommendation from us as part of our task 3, knowing that we'll be spending much of August pulling those detailed recommendations together. So I'm just going to run us down, and I think, Al, what we're looking for is the spreadsheet, not the Word document. See, I can get the Word document. See if you can get your way to the spreadsheet is where we're going to start. That's perfect. Okay, but I'm just going to speak to it, and hopefully all of you have access to it. I see that Hans is in the present, and a number of Dan's there, so most of you know where you're going. I actually spoke to Terry O'Malley this morning about the first item that he had presented about provenance and the time and the individual who did the last data review. I also had a chance to interact with Hans and Ricky about that, and I think Terry's feeling is that there is a desire here to know who and when the most recent review was performed of a given data element. This has not been submitted to OnDeck. This is not in the hopper. There are lots of provenance data elements that are in the hopper, making their way through the process. And Terry's feeling was that he may arrange to have this submitted to OnDeck, but at this point he felt that we didn't need to focus too much on this. So I just wanted to acknowledge that we'd close the loop on that. And again, Al's showing the Word doc, and we're speaking to the spreadsheet at the moment.
Hey, Steve, could you make it a little bigger?
Yeah. Again, we're looking at the wrong doc. There we go. This is the one we want. Oh. Yeah, so now hopefully you can see that one, Clem. And I'd really invite you to pull it up yourself, if you can, on another screen so you
can
navigate as needed. The next one had to do with operative notes. Again, we've discussed this. It's a note type that was not included in USCDI version 1. It has not even been suggested for version 2. No one has weighed in on this on OnDeck. We discussed this and encourage people to do this. But I don't think, again, that there's really a need for our task force to weigh in on this at this point, except really I think just to generally encourage people to engage with OnDeck, to add comments and make their voices heard. But I don't think we need to weigh in. Yes, sir.
I thought the operative note was not explicitly stated, but it was part of the clinical notes.
It's not explicitly stated, and the LOINC code for operative notes, the LOINC code for procedure notes was explicitly included, but the procedure notes, when you look in LOINC, are the non-operative procedures. So, whoever put together B1, specifically included procedure notes and didn't include operative notes, but you're right. You could certainly send them. Our organization is making them available, and everyone is going to need to make them available as part of the transition to all EHI under information blocking in October of 2022. But whether or not somebody wants to add this as a request in OnDeck for us to be considered for version 3, obviously it would be a very small lift. It's just another LOINC code. It would be easy to include that in version 3, but is that going to really make a difference given the transition to all EHI just next year? So again, someone can do that if they think it's worth it, but it's not our place to comment, is my thought.
Stephen, I do think that it's worth a comment only because it's so key to many patient stakeholders who don't have that access now. And it's a common area of suppression when speaking in other committees where folks say operative note's not appropriate, and it is. So we just want to make sure that that doesn't get put under the rug.
Mm-hmm. It's also a common use case for cancer patients, post-op, second opinion, which I know has been a hot topic as well. So the benefit to risk ratio is high.
Yes. Having said that, I don't think it does any good for our task force to weigh in on this in the absence of somebody going to the trouble to make a request in OnDeck.
Stephen, this is Al. The Social Security Administration made a group submission for addition of about, I don't know exactly the number, but it was quite a number of data elements, and I believe that was one of the data elements that were submitted. Well, it was a combined list of clinical notes that Social Security Administration had requested. So technically, I think it was added, but it was just added as a group.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'm capturing this in a spreadsheet. Again, does anybody feel that this is worthy of a task force recommendation to HITACH, given that it's already captured and included? So yes, that's my theory.
Yes.
Okay. So make formal recommendation. All right. I've captured that. Okay. Anything else on that? Okay. Unfortunately, I don't think we wanted Hans to put the link to the document in the public chat. I did that in a prior task force and got my hand slapped for it.
Oh.
We try to keep those to ourselves and not.
I didn't realize this was public. I thought it was the member.
We don't have any public on the phone at the moment, so I think you may be good, and I think we can just invite the ONC to leave that out of our posted minutes. Would probably be best.
Amongst you,
okay.
Chat.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. The next one was reason for visit.
Just a clarification. There is a code called Surgical Operative Notes.
Yep.
3815-1, just for the record.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Okay. All right. Reason for visit. Here again, we felt that this was something that was worth capturing as a data element. Again, we could include that as a task force recommendation, but there is an established process for that being submitted and advanced through the OnDeck system. So I don't know whether anyone feels that warrants a task force recommendation specifically. All right. Well, I'll just let people speak up. Grace, you were the original one who submitted that. I think we all agree that it's a great data element and that it should eventually make its way and that it will be included in all EHI. So there's, you know, it's unclear how that's going to all manifest next year.
Steven?
Yeah.
It's Grace. I'm sorry. I just want to be sure I'm 100% clear here. Everything that anyone added into this Google Doc early on in our process and throughout these task force meetings also needs to be formally submitted in OnDeck to be consistent and comprehensive. Yes?
The only way anything gets into USCDI, as far as we know, is it gets submitted in OnDeck. And then it goes through the process of leveling, prioritization, and selection. So us independently weighing in doesn't provide a path to USCDI inclusion. We can weigh in on things that are in OnDeck, but I think this is one that I don't recall, and maybe Al does, whether this one actually is already in OnDeck.
Reason for visit, I think it is.
Okay.
Can I make a suggestion for process moving forward? Is it possible that we encourage for future task force suggestions, instead of going into a Google Doc, first encouraging OnDeck and pulling down new things that are submitted into a Google Doc for discussion so that we know that they're already formally submitted? Would that help?
Yeah, we did discuss that early on, sort of having an extract of what was in OnDeck to inform our discussions. And I think the feeling was that was going to be a lot of work and that everyone had access to OnDeck and they could look at it. I think, you know, there's a lot of things in OnDeck. There's hundreds of submissions, so it can be a little challenging to find everything and know what's there, and that perhaps having it in a spreadsheet format would make that more valuable. I know, Al, we did talk about that early on, and I don't think we did anything with that. Can you comment?
Well, so as far as a capability to extract, that doesn't exist right now, but Grace, all of the published data elements, which are the ones that were accepted and given a level, is available on the three different tabs of in OnDeck. So level two, which are the ones primarily considered for addition to USCDI future versions, along with level one and comment, which are the ones that might need some additional work. So that's readily available, public, and always updated. So I would caution a little bit about relying on an extracted spreadsheet, which is a point in time snapshot. But that the purpose of those level tabs is to provide the most updated information. So I would recommend relying on that. We are working on an enhanced search function to allow both submitters and reviewers to just go looking for something that they're thinking of. I think that would help. So if we're thinking of reason, you know, you can type in reason in the search field and you should be able to come up with a data element that represents that reason for visit if it's there. So I would lean towards not creating an extract function and just relying on updated information that's on the live website.
Thanks, Al. And again, I do think it makes sense for us when we start the V3 cycle next year to look carefully at what's in level two and have comments on those items that are high priority to advance to the next version. But again, I think spending a lot of time as a task force weighing in on things that are at the comment level or level one really doesn't do us a lot of good. If things are misleveled in our personal perception, you know, we should go in and make those comments in OnDeck as opposed to as a task force, I think. You're good, Grace?
I would encourage us, once it's in OnDeck, though, that we do have that ability. So now if we have some gaps like this, then I think we need to make sure that it's noted and that we can offer the support. So this would be offering support of this contingent upon OnDeck entry.
Perfect. Okay. The next one, and again, I don't mean to be rude, but I also want to make sure we make progress here. The next one was the date of immunization. Again, this was not at, let's see, what was the point here? That we recommended including it in version 2, and then it's already covered in the CDA and US Core. And then I guess we dropped it and left it for this discussion. I don't distinctly recall that discussion. But again, I don't think there's anything in terms of our overall version 3 priorities where we need to weigh in on this so much as waiting for next year's cycle. Okay. The next one was an autopsy report. Again, a very specific report type. I think we did have some discussion about how valuable this is and the fact that it is. I don't recall whether there is a specific link code for this particular report. I don't know if anybody on the call knows that. I don't think it was ever submitted in OnDeck. So, you know, if it's important to a population, you know, it should be submitted and advanced through the process.
So, Steve, just want to clarify, there's a general category that's been approved and is going to come forth above clinical notes. I thought it included all those things. Now, if we start to pick them one at a time, we're going to lose some. I mean, people may not think they have to do the other ones.
The issue is for them, at least it's an oftentimes op note is explicitly not provided, for instance, in open notes. It's explicitly not available easily because it meets the most resistance inside a health system for releasing that information.
Well, there's two things. There's at least 20 operative notes in link from various specialties, currently surgical operative notes. I'll put them in the web. The audition, I think CDA had a very specific that have not just a note, but specific subparts, like blood loss, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Hans may know something about that. I'm not saying we don't want it. I think we want it. I think we just highlight that there's already machinery, and I think it's required in CDA. I don't know for sure.
No, it's not. It's operative node is one of the CCDA document types, but it's not required. It's not and in certification, actually, the there's only three document types that are spelled out. So I think we need to look at that and say which ones are there, which ones are not there, which ones require more work. If they require a specific guidance on how to do it, or is it just a general purpose one?
Okay.
So I think it's important to look at the discussion there to make sure.
I'm for them. Don't get me wrong. I'm absolutely for operative node. It's just that we don't want to distract them from some of the stuff we've already said.
Yeah, and as Al pointed out, there is a submission from Karen P. at the SSA with a long list of specific node LOINC codes, and that suggestion is sitting down at the comment level, which is kind of interesting to me. I'm not sure why it's a comment and why it's not further along, given that these are all, you know, pretty well-established codes, but that's, you know, for ONC to grapple with. I mean, we could certainly provide a recommendation that ONC revisit the comment leveling of that list of code of node types.
Well, whether we ought to also emphasize, because it's already been asserted that all clinical notes should be included, let's pound on that somewhat more. Not have to necessarily.
Well, to be clear, Clem, it's not all clinical notes. I mean, version one included a list of 8 specific clinical notes. And version two, we actually, in draft version two, that was actually shrunk to 5 because we moved some of the ones that were in version one out of there. So the question will be whether version 3 ends up including a longer list, but it's not all clinical notes. It's a very specific list.
That's good. Well, it should include all clinical notes. It's easy enough.
Okay. Well, and that's certainly something that we could include in our recommendations, you know, that all clinical notes, you know, should, you know, all available clinical notes should be included in version 3. I mean, there's nothing wrong with us suggesting that.
Well, I would.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I misunderstood, or I would have been suggesting it all along.
Okay, and I will capture that. Wonderful, good discussion, and we've got that now. All right, there was another one similarly on the results. So one specific test result is blood type. And Leslie and Grace both said, gee, this is really important. You know, this came up in COVID, you know, and lots of patients came and said, gee, I don't know my blood type. Will you please order that? You know, I want that that data to be available. But again, it's just a lab result. I don't think USCDI has any role to play in saying this is a particularly important lab result. And the lab results are already included in US Core and CDA. So I'm not sure that we need to do anything about this.
Well, it's worse than that because there's many, the sort of subtypes of blood type and all. You might, so I think you're right, Steve. You just should include all of them.
And we already do, right? Because we include lab.
Correct. Yeah, right.
Okay, good.
It's So let me ask a question. So how is that, so blood type is often a lab result indicated within an actual visit themselves and not then taken over to a constant that shows up. It's a result within that particular visit. Is there a way to inform or elevate so that blood type is part of the consistent information known about a patient rather than by visit and by individual lab results?
Well, it's a problem because it doesn't always stay the same. And in fact, that's why nobody gets a transfusion without getting it typed again.
Right.
There's also situations where blood type is more important for the particular care setting. The one that comes to mind is right up my old alley, which is pregnancy management. So especially a woman who's Rh negative, there needs to be an almost constant reminder of that fact throughout the course of the pregnancy, especially mid-pregnancy and at delivery. So but the solution to that is that there's different kinds of dashboarding where you can present the most relevant information in a particular setting. And we, ONC hasn't weighed in on what particular requirements for dashboarding or screen layout because there's so many variations to it.
So I guess the question is, is there something for us to do to suggest something about USCVI related to test results, be it blood type, RH, genetic results, you name it, that are constant, could be tested once in a lifetime, and that data should travel, with the patient. But again, they are already test results, so they are already required to travel with the patient. But there is something special about certain results that you only need to test once.
Well, Steve, I think it's really a reporting function we're asking to highlight in some, like a dashboard. And there is an international standard for key data that should travel with the patient. I don't remember where the URL is. That would be what I'd focus on probably. It says these are the things you should always include, when you're traveling or whatever. And it might probably include blood type.
You would think. So again, my question is, do we need to weigh in on this? Given that
I think if we said that some patient information, including lab results like blood type, have a constant value. We encourage ONC and standards organizations to investigate and promote how this type of data can be carried with the patient longitudinally.
Well, I think it's called minimum data set, actually, the one that's international, but...
Are you talking about the international patient summary, international patient access?
Yes.
Topic?
Yeah.
I'm just checking whether they include a blood type explicitly or not.
Do you have the URL? You could put it up.
I think that one is public, so I can put it up in the chat as soon as I get there.
Also, Hans, we were reassured by the team that there was no harm done by posting that link.
Thank you. Plus, it's visible to me right now in the address line.
Ah, good point. Great, great point, Hans. Okay. All right. So is there more work to be done on that or do we, I mean, that doesn't sound like we've really gotten the recommendation nailed. And Al, I wonder if you could slide a few columns to the right so that you're showing columns G through L. I think that would be ideal. Or maybe just hide columns D and D, E, F. Just trying to capture more, showing what we're doing. It sounds to me like we may need to think more about that and get more information about this international patient summary. What did you say it was called, Hans or Clem?
There are two. There's international patient summary and international patient access. I'm about to put in the IPS link in the chat, and I'm then on to access.
Okay. Well, let's not belabor that point. I think we need to come back to that and give it a little bit more thought if nobody disagrees there. The next one was advanced directives. We've had a lot of discussion about advanced directives. The fact that they are in there, that they've been leveled, that we think they're really important, and that we hope that the community provides information that allows ONC to bring them up to level two. Again, not sure what, if any, value we can add at this point, as we recommend priorities for version 3. Any thoughts on a specific recommendation that we would make around advanced directives, Mark? I mean, yeah, go ahead.
This may be a place where it's worth ONC inviting, not just being silent, and ONC usually isn't just silent, but actually explicitly inviting people to move a little more quickly on this one.
Well, it is, I also agree it's very important, but it's a tough problem. I don't think we can whitewash that. You know, you got to have the most recent one. There's no common place for the storing them where you can go and find what they are. Patients are often not able to talk when they come in with the state. They look in their hospital record. Okay, that would count. I mean, there's deep problems, and I think we really need a central place for them to make this work.
There has been significant work done that Lisa Nelson has shepherded through HL7 around advanced directives to help to resolve that problem. But throwing up our hands and saying it's tough, I think, is not a reason not to try to promote it. And especially Pulse, Molts, and Advanced Directives, Pulse and Molts, there's definitely a construct for that. Advanced Directives, there is a requirement. If someone says, yes, I have one, then we're obligated to go find it and put it in a record. So I think there is work being done, and the only way it will continue to be done is with pressure. So I would advocate that we want to place emphasis and promotion of advanced directive Pulse and Molts, especially during COVID. We had patients with no family members at end of life. We had just a dearth of data around this, and it was so highlighted in COVID, I think we need to emphasize it.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. I just worry about specifying something to be done without having the machinery to do it, and if we should push
We did put this in the consolidated CDA patient-generated data specifically around advanced directives, so there's some standards there, but there's more work that's been done since then. So
okay.
I would suggest that we get some more information about this and add it, but work has progressed dramatically.
Good, okay.
Yeah, and there's definitely a project in flight. Corey Spears and Lisa Nichols are working on that.
All right. Thank you, Hans, for finding those HL7 documents. It doesn't sound like either one of those has a specific reference regarding the blood type or other once-in-a-lifetime tests.
They could hold it. It's just that it's not explicitly stated.
Sure. Right.
Even a genetic test, they redo because of some new methods and some new databases and all that. So it's a tough space.
Okay. I think we will also come back and look at how we might craft a recommendation around greater ONC focus on advanced directives. It's not immediately clear how we would phrase that, but I think that might be a job for August. So we've got that captured. The next one had to do with location of work. And the recommendation to include this as part of work information or social determinants of health employment information, which are both leveled. One was leveled as level one, the other leveled as a comment. Mark previously made a comment that Gravity Project's employment status domain is in process. So we've talked about this. It's going through the process. It's been captured by a couple of different folks at a couple of different levels. Not clear to me what value we can add other than encouraging people to weigh in and work the process. Anyone feel that this requires specific focus from us? right, see no hands, hear no voices. We'll keep going. The next one was unique device identifier, devices used or applied, CMS. Had weighed in and suggested we include this in version 3, or that this be included in version 3. Again, we had said we recommend discrete codes for devices used by a patient. Gave some examples, can be represented by the fire resource device use statement. This is not profiled in U.S. Core beyond implantable devices, and it's not supported in CDA beyond implantable devices. So the focus really has been implanted devices as opposed to applied or otherwise utilized devices. I think, you know, there clearly is an opportunity here for the industry to make suggestions to include this. CMS, I believe, has already submitted this. Michelle, are you on? I don't see you. So anything else about this?
Well, two thoughts. One is the implanted devices, I still don't think is working well. That stuff is carried in the surgery systems, and they haven't made the hard link with it, that they could just deliver the stuff automatically. Because, say, the guy checking out the physician discharging a patient, it's a chore to figure out what the heck these device numbers are. But the surgery system to put it in the body knows. Second thing is about devices the patient carries. I think that's an excessively burdensome thing. I mean, if they have a home blood pressure cuff, they have every people, you know, home. What does it matter if they own one, if they're not, you know, just, and how are you going to get the code for that if you're doing a primary care doc, get 10 minutes to see the patient? I think that's overkill.
So let me address first the implantable devices. I think there has been dramatic work done. It's been important in supply chain and as a patient with two of them. It's important to know when recalls happen, and that was some of the emphasis, not just for CMS. And so it's in meaningful use. It's in VDT. So implantable devices need to be continued. For the actual devices themselves for wearable, we could provide some sort of direction statement that says whether it's wearable or used devices inside in a health system. For instance, the issues around COVID were devices that were public health had a dramatic interest in, and I think we heard that in our session last week. And so perhaps we need to just work on this a bit. I do agree with you, Clem, that there is a plethora of wearable devices that may or may not be relevant or even captured, but there is also the need to continue the work we're doing on implantable devices and devices that are wearable but incorporated into the medical record by design, like cardiac devices that are sent home with a patient, that are actually prescribed to the patient for use. And so perhaps we can be clear about that.
I just worry about how you capture all this stuff when it's mixed use. They may not have it anymore. It's in a drawer somewhere. How do you even figure it out?
I think the emphasis is on prescribed devices that are wearable in the home. Okay.
Yeah.
And that would be helpful clarification to now, because the interpretation otherwise might be a variety of devices that have been used in clinical care. And we've seen during COVID with electronic lab reporting in particular, that getting the information on the devices that were actually used in performing the tests is very hard to do because the systems have just not accommodated at the level of detail you need to make that useful beyond a free text, whatever people enter. And it's a similar kind of issue as Glenn described. The surgery suite is where the implantable device really becomes known, other than if it's a historical recollection by either a provider or a patient. So that has been a challenge to therefore get good, accurate information from the source rather than down the line. And that's similarly the case with lab instruments, is that it's really the lab and the devices that know that should know it, but they just are not capturing it at that level of detail. And that's a lot of effort to get it into the chain. So narrowing the scope on what it's what goes with the patient home would be very helpful to make that more manageable. And the FDA is already trying to progress the other ones as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the key is that it's a prescribed device.
I think that
could
helps.
I make a comment?
Who's that? Michelle?
I was Grace.
Is that you? Grace. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Just from the patient perspective, any of the devices that are implanted, if a patient or their care partner has any challenges and they need to call the manufacturer, the first thing that they ask for is the device ID, the model number, and they won't even field your call without it. So while I can appreciate it's challenging, patients and their families are expected to keep track of these if there's any sort of troubleshooting or questions that require a call to the manufacturer.
Well, sure. I think that one's sort of easy. If they just made the linkage from the surgical suite to the medical record, then it's not been pushed or focused on yet.
So let me just clarify
for
everyone.
So it is required
the
under
unique device identifier. Well, it's also in USCDI version 1. I mean, this the unique
right.
device identifier is already there. Down
sure.
at level
yep.
2, there are a number of additional items that have been suggested, the expiration date, the identification code, the lot number, the manufacturing date, the serial number. So people have thought deeply already and made submissions about additional specific data elements that would be preferred here. But again, this has all been on implantable devices. I think what was raised by Michelle and CMS had to do with applied devices. So that's the change. Leslie has suggested that we focus only on those that have been prescribed for use as opposed to just whatever the patient happens to be using. And I guess I just want to see if we feel that this warrants a recommendation from our task force, knowing that Michelle and CMS have already done this.
Those are really good suggestions because the deliverer of the prescription will know or could know that ID and pass it on.
Pharmacy probably not, though. I mean, well, I prescribe these all the time. You know, I say, go get an blood pressure cuff and use it. You know, go get a Freestyle Libre and use it. Use your Apple Watch. I don't know anything about what they end up buying or using.
Okay.
Stephen, I have one comment at an appropriate time.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
But just, I think the idea of prescribed may make sense to me as a management tool at this point in time, but USCDI and what we're the ecosystem go beyond just what's in an EHR. So we're having conversation about patient devices and SDOH. You're going to have things going back and forth between patients and community referral providers. I know from my work at UCSF, the kinds of things that happen with diabetes and insulin pumps and continuous glucose monitors and how those things can sometimes be patched. And so I would say if we're going to say prescribed, I would say it's sort of a temporary, it's a management tool for this point in time, but it's a broader ecosystem. It's not just what the doctor prescribes. The patient has a role in this too.
A really good point. So again, does our task force have a need to say anything about this as we suggest priorities for version 3?
I think it's an overarching principle that we identify that devices will be continue to be prescribed, used by patients, and that data will become more material to care as more care is pushed into the home and with telehealth and others. And we encourage ONC to launch and support a broader review of device interoperability.
Could I add a little to that? I think if you use the UID, that makes it harder for these broader applications. but maybe we need a vocabulary of devices that people can just look up and say without having to find the device to find what the number is and all that stuff.
That actually has been one of the challenges between the FDA GUID and what the manufacturers provide in their documentation, what's on transactions, is to get the correct device identifier that you can use, or whether it is free text because of how it's done, or whether it's scanned. It's that the actual documentation and collection mechanism is the challenge, not the can you have it in the system for implantable devices even. So that's where we need to just be aware of that.
Yes. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. I continue to try to capture thoughts in the document that we're all viewing together. Do people feel that this should be a formal Task 3 recommendation? Again, it's not specifically about version 3. It's more sort of overarching, but we can do what we want.
This is Mark. I do.
Okay. So those are getting the yellow highlights. The ones getting the green highlight are more, we need to think about this some more. Okay, we're actually doing great. Thank you all for the great discussion. The next one actually came out of our discussion with the ISP task force, which had to do with a ventilator, pump, dialysis, and other device settings. Again, it's not about unique device identifiers, it's about device settings. This, you know, one thought would be to expand the title of the UDI data class, but I think there's probably plenty there already. This would probably be a new data class having to do with device settings. Again, this is one of those things where it's like, really, if you're using, you know, if you're in a community health center, you know, using an ambulatory EHR, do you really need to know what the pump settings were on the patient's dialysis or ventilator when they were in the ICU? You know, so the question of, is this really the role of the USCDI, you know, defining the core data of interoperability? But, you know, but this was raised by the ISP group, so thought we would bring it here for further discussion.
So, Steve, those are observations in many worlds, and they're generated by ICU systems, and there's line codes for lots of them. So there's a big ICU system at Israel that's part of this MIMIC. They have many of those kinds of dimensions in them. So does IEEE and their anesthesia systems. So it's a variable that's out there electronically and could be captured and standardized if there was interest. It's not a matter of people having to, they won't have to read it. Just like you don't read the whole ICU.
And again, by definition, this is going to be included in all EHI next year and will be required for access, exchange, and use. So my personal feeling is that this doesn't belong in USCDI, that we're not going to eventually want every, you know, small office practice EMR to be able to capture this from the ICU system. I think it's important data, and I'm glad it's going to be in all EHI. But I personally don't think it belongs in USCDI. John Kilbourne, you have your hand up.
That was a mistake. I didn't mean I was cleaning the screen with my finger. Sorry.
Okay. John Kilbourne, you have your hand down.
Why you got me, though, I would agree that this seems it would be unwieldy to require this. There seems to be higher priority items if we're going to require, you know, items to be exchanged than ventilator settings, like ventilator settings that you had, you know, last month. I don't know how applicable they are in the future, for instance. So I'm agreeing with the idea that this may not be a high priority.
I think that the discussion came from public health on ventilator status and settings for COVID analysis and research, and it was a one-time thing. I think that the dialysis settings also were brought up in the context of, have we looked at devices by disease type? So do we need to be more specific about that? I think it's still, I don't think we have enough here to make a recommendation. Overall, there does need to be support of especially a disease-based function, whether it's renal issues or cancer issues, where devices themselves contribute to the overall ongoing status of the patient's care record. But that's just too hard to do to describe. So the two use cases were disease-specific and or research for use in ventilators and others post-COVID.
Well, one more input, and I don't disagree with anything that's been said about the importance of the urgency, but Medicare requires the collection of detailed dialysis stuff on a monthly basis already, and there's a standard codes for it, too, just for the record.
Hans, your hand is up.
Yeah, a question and a note. Question is that on the last comment in the cell, seems not to fit. Is there or is there not agreement whether the settings are part of the EHI designated record set definition or not? That's probably one of those who's starting to become grayish areas. So it's an open question that might become more, but I'm not sure what it is. And that might drive as well whether it should or should not be considered. A second part is just a note for the settings in fire, in the fire side, are currently being modeled more likely to be in R5 than in R4 because that's already closed, and they're not following the observation model as has been done in the past in version 2. So just as a heads up. They're modeled differently, but they are being addressed. Work is in progress to really understand them better and see where they fit, and how to get them in.
All right, so that's all helpful. I've captured that in the comment. Thank you. I guess just a quickie for Al, or maybe not so quickie. My intuitive sense of all electronic health information would include electronic health information maintained in surgical and anesthesia systems, and that information blocking would require that data to be extractable and accessible in a machine-readable format. I think that's how most people see this. Al, can you comment one way or the other, since Hans raised the question as to whether that would be included in all EHI?
I don't know. I'll have to look into it. I'll take the question and come up with an answer. I don't have it right now.
Okay. Thanks.
Stephen,
all right.
I think another answer to that is it would be in the designated record set.
I would think. Yeah.
So I think it probably, since it's electronic, it's probably EHI too, but I understand Al's point about wanting to check.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then I think while maybe it's not a high priority, assuming that it's considered part of EHI because it's part of DRS, and as it becomes electronic, therefore it's EHI, while it might not be the highest priority, perhaps, I will go back to the argument that then it should become a target for US CDI.
Well, it's going to be sitting electronically somewhere, and so it's be relatively free to get it in terms of manual labor.
The question is, what drives the standards to get on the same page? And right now, that is US CDI more so than just EHI.
Well, I guess my question, Hans, is whether core data for interoperability, and again, I keep thinking about the little rural doctor's office or the community health center, you know, whether they need to have a system that can capture and store these device settings and pass them on to somebody else, you know, when these were really very specific to either, you know, the transfusion or the ICU or, you know, the OR, that's really the question that I have. I mean, I think having it as part of the DRS and all EHI makes perfect sense, but I'm not sure it makes sense to be in USCDI. Until we say USCDI is meant to expand to all EHI, which is a different discussion. Right.
And I think that the two discussions of is the goal for USCDI to at least encompass EHI, and within USCDI, as you do that, the point that you're making completely agreed, there are settings and there are systems where some of this data is not relevant or that you would not need to worry about. And that goes back to the comments around stratification. So those two things go hand in hand to make sure that the right settings are or are not encumbered by data requirements or systems that are not relevant in their context, but they are part of designated record set. So we do want to make sure that they are exchangeable in a standard format. So it's a little bit of an interplay between those that that we need to have clarity to. It's not just one or the other.
I think you're making a good point, and I want to emphasize that the ICU data, even if it's lab tests, can be overwhelming to a practice. So there's two questions. I think it's that the systems have to be able to handle it. These would just be different codes on the same kind of data structure most of the time, I think. So I don't know that it's a big deal. But then the question is, does a physician's office have to receive everything that the hospital delivers? That's a big question. Because even inpatient could kill the inpatient office system.
Okay, I don't think we're going to resolve this right now.
Yeah.
And I don't think we have to, but it's a great discussion. So we've had a couple of sort of late submissions. Mark was kind enough to put together a lot of good thinking about patient-generated health data as well as priorities. And then Grace has recently added a comment about tumor board notes. Mark, do you want to tackle this here and now, or do you want to wait until we get to the Word doc? What's your preference?
I'm at your pleasure, whichever you prefer.
All right. And Grace, I think yours is kind of quick, so why don't we do that? Again, you've identified an interesting note type, tumor board notes. I'm not sure they would be considered progress notes. I don't think we determined that they would be in our organization, though I imagine some people might. They're obviously very important documentation and potentially of great interest to patients and caregivers. So I totally get that. I think they also would be helpful to exchange between organizations if a patient is receiving care at multiple organizations or transitions their care. Again, a specific subtype of a clinical note. Does anybody know offhand, Al or Dan or anybody, whether there is a request in OnDeck for tumor board notes to be added?
I'm not aware.
So I'd go back to the idea of we take all clinical notes, because some places might classify those as multidisciplinary notes or whatever, and we're going to
exactly.
Lose stuff if it's too specific.
Yeah. No, and we've already captured that. Thanks again for that reminder, Clem. And when I look at the SSA recommendation, they have this long list of specific note types. They're not in alphabetical order. So just glancing through it, I don't see tumor board jumping out at me. But again, I think this is one of those things that somebody should probably submit in OnDeck and get it leveled, see if there is a link code for that. I don't know. Dan, do you remember? Is there a link code for tumor board notes?
Of course.
There you go.
Yeah. I think this is Leslie. I think the emphasis here was that it's often not included in view, download, and transmit right now. And so having it called out in USCDI can help for patient access. So it's one of those notes like op notes that are often left out of open note strategies. And we want to make sure that, especially with our cancer patients, that is more visible.
Yeah. But again, I don't know that I don't think it's our role as a task force to advocate for individual data elements that have not yet been submitted, right? Our role is really to comment on things. So there's a line code. I just found it. Thanks, Dan. That was an easy search. And someone should ask for that to be made part of USCDI. I totally agree.
But shouldn't it be there anyway, whether anybody asks for it or not? That's what I'm keep coming back to
them. Well, yes, but we got that. Yeah, we got that already. We got that all notes should be included. But if somebody wants to make a particular ask around this one, they need to do that. That's all we're saying.
Now, could I bring up something I talked about before? And I don't know where it stands with the ophthalmology tonometry. You know, they NIH submitted it. I brought it up a couple meetings, and it just kind of fell off. It's used electronically.
No, Clem, it didn't fall off at all. We actually discussed it at HITAC.
Good. All right.
Yeah. We specifically discussed it in our phase one recommendations.
But is it in phase? It going to be in three? Is it still?
We don't know if it's going to be in two. I mean, we don't know until next week or next month whether it's going to be in two, and then we can take on whether it's going to be in three next year.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry I forgot that twist.
Yeah. Okay, can I hand it off to you, Mark? Let's see, where are we at? We're at 8:37. We got good time. Yeah, I think, Mark, you can tackle this.
Okay. So for some reason, which one are we on, if you can just point me in the right direction?
I brought it up in the list. It's now on row 48, and it is, you say, add a patient-generated health data class.
Okay. So this is just a sort of a recognition of sort of a more tailored recognition of the broader discussion, which you highlighted last time, Stephen, about right access. And I was thinking about that and thought that focusing on patient-generated health data, which was a part of the meaningful use approach, but then was dropped, was perhaps a good way to structure a task force conversation about it. As I was thinking about it, I was thinking that a lot of elements that might be collected together in such a data class have already been discussed. They're already present in other places, and I gave some examples there: family health history, patient demographics, pregnancy status, social determinants of health. Those might come from patients might submit those. There may be some that are new. So this is a recommendation to start the discussion and get ONC thinking and inviting how to bring this together.
One thing I'll add, Mark, and Al had a chance to clarify this, I think, yet again for me on another call, is that ONC is not interested at this point in supporting the replication of data elements in multiple data classes. So as you say, a lot of these data elements are already captured. There's no specification as related to whether who captured the data or in what type of system it was captured. You know, USCDI is about the data, and these are already part of USCDI. There's certainly, and we've been discussing device data, which of course is patient generated in many situations, which might go under another class. I think that in my mind, the purpose of having a new class in USCDI would be to hold new data elements. So I guess the question is, are there new data elements that would fit in a patient-generated health data class that wouldn't fit anywhere else? Because if not, I'm not sure we need the class so much as sort of a discussion that there's a use case related to patient-generated health data. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think what we've got is like the consolidated CDA covers a patient observation result finding in the same way. It just has a new stakeholder or author indicated as the patient or the patient's team member. So much of this is when we did this construct, it was trying to think about it as observation, results in the same construct as a provider. So how do we indicate when that the USCDI should add a new authors of existing standards? There's nothing in ONDEC that would indicate that kind of distinction. What's your thoughts, Al?
What Stephen said, accurately represents the position that we've taken in the past about the data itself is separate than the author of the data. And if you want to consider, my personal opinion is there's a lot of stuff in healthcare that's patient generated, including a symptom, a questionnaire response, anything that asks a question of a patient is patient generated data, even though it comes across as like an audit C score or a hunger vital sign score. Those are patient generated data. It's just who was actually writing it down or typing it in. So we do have author organization and author timestamp for provenance, which can apply to any of the data. And if I don't know if author organization has a capability of accommodating a patient or self, but something like that construct of pairing two things, a data element and a provenance, I think that is designed to be modular. USCBI with those data elements are supposed to be are designed to be modular. And so I'm personally struggling with like getting examples of what is uniquely patient generated data that's not otherwise an observation or a finding.
Or a questionnaire, and it's a catch 22, because when the group started working on patient generated health data, this was under the standards committee, we looked at how do we make this as compatible with existing structure, how do we make it as compatible with current movement of data, and so that's why the work was done under the consolidated CDA with a new header that indicated this new author type. So now here we are where, yes, it's not unique data class and it's probably not unique data elements, it's just a new author. How do we promote the inclusion of this new author type into Exchange? And that is, where do we take that? How do we promote a new author type with Exchange?
And perhaps this is Hans. Perhaps we can suggest that it's being thought of as a data element, not a data class, but a data element, and that you look at either of the data classes, allergies, health concerns, procedures, etc. In FHIR, they pretty much all can have an author, and they may be the patient at times or a person. It could be somebody else than that. We can use UUCI that the data element is author and the vocabulary behind it is the set that we believe at that point in time is the right ones to extend it to. And that would include a patient or a person on behalf, a caregiver, and that we get explicit about it. I'd use the data element.
It's interesting. As a clinician, I'll add that this comes up when we talk about vital signs, and it's come up specifically this past year with virtual visits. And when we're quote rooming a patient for a virtual visit, and we ask them to report their blood pressure, their pulse, their weight, etc., whether that data should be filed in the exact same data element as if it were being collected by a healthcare professional in a clinical setting, or whether it should be a different data element for patient-reported blood pressure, pulse, what have temperature, O2 sat, what have you, and then leave it up to the system to determine whether patient-generated vital signs get graphed in the same place with clinically generated vital signs, or whether they're kept separate, or whether you could have it, either or. I think again, I don't think we make a big point about differentiating whether a blood pressure was collected by a physician, a nurse, or an ER tech. But we're saying, but if it's collected by the patient, then that's a totally different thing. It's an open question, and I think I'd love to hear from maybe Sasha or Hans about how the certified health IT systems manage this, and whether there would be value in USCDI wading into this area, or whether this should just be left to industry to sort out.
I'll let Sasha go first, and then I'll go back to the other comment that I just made.
Yeah, I was thinking about quality reporting as an example, since I know there's been some headache to your example, Stephen, of patient-captured vitals in the quality reporting context, because CMS does attempt to draw a distinction, but some of our standards don't make that distinction very well. The quality reporting standards with CQL, for example, don't have a good way to express the distinction between who captures the vitals, even if that's a concept that CMS seems interested in for quality reporting. All that, though, is kind of musing in my head. I don't know that I have a great sense of the best way to tackle this in USCDI. I agree it doesn't seem necessarily a different data class, and it may not be the only example of this either. Patient generation is sort of not the only maybe provenance or provenance-related status that would be of interest. You know, there's other things that folks are interested in distinguishing within their systems, such as, you know, whether the author was part of your organization or another organization, or whether the source was, you know, to some extent or another, how trusted the other source was, whether it's, you know, another clinic that you would place a high degree of trust in, or whether it's data that, you know, sourced from maybe a long chain of claims or something, and you don't have as high of a sense of its clinical validity. And I don't, you know, there's maybe a wider conversation there to think about how we want to handle all of those in USCDI.
Yeah. Adding to that is that the modeling approach that FHIR is using is that they allow for multiple or different and multiple authors and types. So distinguishing the data that way, however a system internally manages that, it's up to them. But from a communication perspective, interoperability perspective, it's the same kind of data, perhaps maybe more or less structured or textual because of the nature of the source. But the author is then the one that indicates where it belongs to in that regard as the source. So that's a very natural way to do it. I completely agree. Is that, have we done full support of that? Is that problematic in some areas in the way that that measures or otherwise are being expressed, how you can include it or exclude it? But if we're talking at it from an interoperability perspective, it's the most natural place to do that as an author, because it's otherwise effectively the same data. So that's I think where we need to consider that and manage it in USCDI as a data element of the classes where we care about that, and where we want to be more explicit to ensure is that is it only the clinician, is it the patient, is it perhaps another source, and when I say patient or their caregiver, so that seems the most natural place to actually manage that. And yes, we have a bit to go through to make sure is that data is then properly stratified and segregated, depending on whether it's to be included in a measure or not, how systems manage it internally for other reasons. But that's not interoperability. That's their individual capabilities to handle that.
Could I make a comment? This is Clem.
Sure.
Well, firstly, I think the key
and then Dan thing, has his hand up after you.
The key thing is the data is the type of author that we want to distinguish. And what you show in a display or a post, that's all a reporting function. It shouldn't be part of the standards of what you send. But lurking under all this is something Mark brought up about right access. And that's a huge challenge, ranging. Most systems don't allow much right access to anything. And it's a challenge because the codings may not line up. It's a challenge because people could shut your system down by overloading it. There's all kinds of challenges. And there's a challenge because the physician has to be responsible for every, you know, every data element that comes in at any time of the day or night. They're gonna get pretty stressed out. They're not going to be able to do it unless there's a two-way agreement about what comes in. So just something to think about. If we're talking about right access, open right access, it's a tough challenge.
this is less, I don't think we're talking about the open right access, but when we did start describing this in use cases, it was a patient response to a physician request. That was kind of the easiest first place to do patient-generated data.
Okay.
So it was questionnaire response. It was advanced directive. It was a finding, observation, or result. And that was one that we felt had the most likelihood for early adoption. But once we move, I think, to a FHIR-based approach, the natural conclusion or evolution of any request for data is a response. And so we will evolve to have more of a dialogue than a single query. There'll be more in the future. But right now, we want to make sure that any requested information of a patient can be included and interoperable with the patient as an author in response.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Just a quick comment hearkening back to the ONC discussion in 2013 to 2015, that the HIPAA right to submit a correction or an amendment to the record is also an example of patient-generated health data, and it's actually been around for 20 years. So there are some new examples, but there are also some longstanding examples of how this is helpful. Thanks.
Advanced directives as well.
Yep. Birth plans.
Okay. So I'm going to wrap this back to you, Mark. Is there a need? Oh, I'm sorry, Dan. You're up. My bad.
I'll just go ahead. I'll be brief and say I want to strongly support Hans's comments from the perspective of USCDI. We absolutely should be sure that we can designate the performer or the author or the creator of the kinds of data that we want as a separate attribute that drives all these things. And we absolutely do not want to create different, you know, measurements, observations, questionnaires based on who submitted it. And so that, I think, is sort of a key principle. Notwithstanding what Mark was just talking about, which is that if there are classes of data elements that, you know, sort of are almost always generated in the context of patient initiation, I'll say we still want to include those. But for the most part, whether it's a heart rate, a blood pressure, a questionnaire, et cetera, we definitely don't want separate patient-specific variables for those.
You're here.
And let me just add, before we go to public comment, you can pull up the comment slide if you like, that version one of USCDI already includes author, organization, and timestamp. We specifically left out author because it was felt that that was challenging, but that is already at level two. And then at level one, there is source submitted by DaVinci having to do with, you know, what sort of data system sent you this data. And then at the comment level, there are already a whole host of additional provenance items, including author credentials and author roles, which we have discussed and would capture this data. So there's no lack of submissions to cover this. And I think, you know, brings us back to the question which we'll take up after public comment as to whether we need to do anything about this notion of a new data class. So let's go to public comment.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Operator, can we please open the line for public comments?
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate the line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up the handset before pressing the star keys. We will pause for a brief moment to poll for comments.
And while we're waiting, I'll just note that the task force is taking a few weeks of well-deserved time off, and we will be reconvening on Tuesday, July 20th at our usual time, 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Operator, do we have any public comments?
There are no comments at this time.
All right, thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, Mark, back to your initial Hans, your hand is up. Sorry. Hans.
Yes, based on your comment, Stephen, just before the public comment break, I think we need to be considering that provenance as a data class effectively applies to all other classes in that it needs to, that it's providing the provenance of each one of those, and what do we need to keep track of. If we in there, just in there, add to the provenance author, patient, and caregiver as an example, that would imply, unless we don't mean that, imply that it is applicable to all other data classes as USCDI is growing. And maybe not all data classes are going to be relevant that the patient is the source for that, perhaps. But we need to consider that so that we can still then on the individual classes where it would not apply or where we want to explicitly make sure, we still have to go through that to make sure that provenance suddenly does not, with an author perspective, implies that across the board that everything must be patient-generated if that's not what we mean.
Well, Hans, I would say that that's the case in every author has relevance. It, or it's material to certain types of data and certain types it's not relevant, right? So you're not going to have the anesthesiologist record being performed by the radiologist. So it's just there is a sense of material or relevance that has to apply for any author.
And that's the reason why I would suggest that we have to be careful looking at provenance as the sole place for declaring author, that we have to do it on each of the respective data classes to make sure there's no confusion around that.
And I'll give credit to Gary Dickinson, who submitted author role as an item that has been leveled as a comment, and he does specifically reference FHIR HL7 tools for supporting this. So, Mark, don't see any more hands, so I'm going to try to get through this. Is there a need, Mark, for a separate data class for patient-generated health data at this point?
The comment that we shouldn't have data elements in multiple classes, that continues to make sense. We've talked about that before. I think where this comes from me is I'm looking at recommendation 2 from the ISP task force about thinking about a roadmap, sort of a broader structure for, there they mentioned administrative and research, but I'm thinking about patient-generated health data. And I think that's actually sort of the conversation we've just been having. How do we integrate the patient source of data the same way we've been paying attention to the clinical source of data? I think that conversation is worth continuing. Whether, to your specific question about whether we're ready for a patient-generated health data class, not so clear about that. I am clear about the broader conversation, though, the need for a broader roadmap. I think I'll close with it saying there's a few examples that I hadn't highlighted before, the OTC, the over-the-counter medications. I think there are some things that we acknowledge are important clinically, but they would come from patients. So I think there's still some room for additions, but maybe that's a little more on the margins of your question, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're at time, Mark. We did not get to your other suggestion around priorities, which I think is going to be a great place for us to take up our discussion when we meet again in 3 weeks. We will encourage folks to continue to review our Word document. Mark's items did get captured in that document as well, along with some other items that came out of our discussions with the ISP Task Force and Public Health. So looking forward to seeing everybody, hopefully, to discuss the USCDI version 2 and the V3 submission process on July 20th, followed by our discussion, our deep dive on social determinants of health on the 27th. And then we will determine what we're going to be doing in August to pull all of this together. But I think we can probably plan now to have a meeting on August 3rd to pick up this discussion. The 10th is during HIMSS. So I would invite the ONC team to calendar us for August 3rd to continue our discussion here. And with that, thank you all very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks everyone.
So much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.